page 75, and if we wanted to get our bearings, the rabbi has made a claim that we talked about last week, and the claim was that the Torah is the most reliable document as far as its transmission. It's extremely reliable, it's not given to falsification, and the information that's contained in the Torah is completely reliable. It's completely accurate. And he's now going to set about to sort of stake that claim and to try and prove that. I want to try and prove to you, he says, how reliable the Torah is as a historical document of what actually happened throughout the history of the world from the time of creation until the giving of the Torah, and from the giving of the Torah until and from the time of the giving of the Torah till the present time, we have a reliable transmission as well. So the first thing that he's going to set about to prove is that the Torah is a reliable historical document from the time of creation until the time that it was written down. And the argument that we're going to see presented here is that if the author of this biblical document wanted to lie, if that was really, if this really is a falsification, if it's not true, then he would have chosen a better lie. Now, let's think in those terms. If you wanted to write something that was to start your own religion based upon a document that you were going to claim was from God, the two things that you would want to do in order to be able to avoid being exposed as a fraud is that, number one, you would want to try and talk about things that happened millennia ago. You want to talk about things that happened eons and eons ago when there's no possibility that someone would say, wait a minute, we have historical documents from the time that you're talking about, and no one that was around at that time, there's no documentation, there's no archaeological evidence whatsoever of the claims that you are making. So if I wanted to claim, let's say, for example, that 500 years ago, there was a group of aliens that came down in a spaceship from Mars, and they brought these special tablets, and on these tablets contained special commandments about how we had to worship the green men of Mars. So the first thing that I would want to do is to make sure that there was no one else around 500 years ago to be able to disprove what I was claiming. So I would either say that it happened in a very, very remote location where no one was there, which is what the claims of Joseph Smith were when we talk about the founding of Mormon. Or I'd want to make sure that it happened so many eons ago that no one could have been there because it just happened prehistorically. No one would possibly remember it. Another thing that I would want to do is I would want to make sure that the experience that I'm claiming happened was only a private revelation. It was not something that was exposed to the masses. Because if I was lying, and I made a claim that this was heard around the world, that everyone heard about the Martians that came down 500 years ago, and it was a public spectacle that the entire world knew about, then someone would be able to come forward and say, listen, you know, I want to believe you, but come on, this is ridiculous. I mean, we have records of what happened 500 years ago, and no one, up until you came along today, has made this claim that there were green men in a spaceship that came down from Mars and brought us some kind of information. So the fact that you're making this claim sounds extremely incredible. It's not something that we can accept. Yeah. So that's really where Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to be coming from. He's going to be saying that the claims of the Torah, if they were a lie, Moshe or whoever wrote the Torah would have given us a better lie. It would have been a lie that would have been less subject to being refuted. It would have been less subject to someone poking holes at it and saying, come on, that can't possibly be. We were around, or at least our ancestors were around, and there's no historical record of what you claim happened. And let's think about that when we talk about really outlandish stories like the Tower of Babel, where there's a claim in the Torah that all of a sudden, where there was only one language, on Monday. On Tuesday, people started speaking 70 languages. Or let's talk about another claim in the Torah where there was an entire race of people, the world was populated, and then all of a sudden there was a flood, entire mankind gets wiped out, and the world gets repopulated by one man and his family. Now those claims are claims that Moshe Rabbeinu makes to the Jewish people in the Sinai Desert just a few hundred years after these events are purported to have taken place. And there must have been something in the collective memory of Egyptian society and other in other societies that were around during this period of ancient civilization that either had some recollection of these ideas or would have said, come on, that's ridiculous. We know that the world has been around for X number of years. We have memory and we have records and we have an oral tradition of other races and other peoples and other civilizations that have existed long before you claim that there was a flood. Here's the remnant of that civilization. They still exist today. Or, you know, the Tower of Babel, that's ridiculous. We have records of people speaking different languages well before the story took place. So this is the kind of line of argumentation that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to make. So now, one of the things that I would ask you to think about is to look at this critically and say to yourself, does this seem compelling to me? Is this a legitimate line of argumentation to prove the authenticity of the Torah or the stories that are contained in the Torah? Or can we poke holes in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's proofs? If indeed they are proofs, and can we say that, you know, this doesn't resonate with me, I find a way of poking holes in it. Yeah.
If you look at a religion like the Mormon religion,
yes,
which is relatively new,
yes,
which was a private revelation, I'm not talking about the Mormon, but it's a ridiculous premise, the whole religion is finding broken tablets somewhere in the temple base. And yet this religion has grown and is continuing to grow worldwide. I mean, isn't the basis for Judaism just emunah that, you know, Anochi Hashem is in it?
So the question is a very, very, very good question. The question is, you're sort of asking two questions in one. The first part of your question is, well, what about other religions that have gained popularity since the founding of Judaism that are based upon even more outlandish claims than Judaism, and yet they still seem to have lasting power? And then the second question that you're asking is, why do we need to bother with these proofs at all? Isn't it based on emunah? And if that's all it's based upon, then why do we have to go through this exercise in the first place? Those are two actually very different questions, and I think they both deserve an answer. To answer your first question, I would agree with you that there are more outlandish claims that are made by other religions that have lasting power, but it's important to remember that the claims of those other faiths are not as solid as the claim that the Torah makes about mass revelation. The claims of the Torah is that there were dramatic changes, not only an individual revelation out in the desert that somebody had, that Joseph Smith might have had, or that Muhammad had, or that Jesus revealed to a small group of disciples, but rather that there was a revelation en masse to millions of people, and that the entire world changed as a result of the flood or as a result of the Tower of Babel. None of these other religions make such a claim. None of these other more recent religions makes a claim that something happened on that, this kind of magnitude, on that scale of affecting the entire world. So that's the reason why other religions are able to get away with even more outlandish claims than are contained in the Torah, because when you talk about a private revelation, you can say whatever you want. I can tell you that last night I was beamed up to a spaceship, and they did experimentation on my body, and I met my clone, and actually he was beamed down in my place, and you're speaking to a clone right now. And you would never know the difference. You'd never know whether I'm telling you the truth or not, because there's no way for you to either prove it or disprove it, right?
You got a lot of suspicion.
You'll never know, right? So, the reason why that claim is can be made in the first place is because it's not subject to refutation. No one can say that they were there, because I'm saying that it was a private experience. But the Torah makes claims that are supposed to, where the whole world is involved in this kind of experience, and it's a very difficult claim to make if it never happened. The Torah should have made much more modest claims if it was a lie. And that's basically the line of reasoning of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's entire, throughout his entire work. If it was a lie, it should have been a better lie. That's the line of argumentation. So then to answer your second question, aren't these matters of faith? And so therefore, why do we need to make these lines of argumentation to begin with? Why do we have to present these proofs to begin with? Now that's a very good argument that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi himself concedes to. At some point, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi takes a very anti-philosophical perspective. And as an anti-philosopher, which we talked about before, he doesn't feel that proving things intellectually to a person is what makes you into a true believer, is what makes you into a true devotee of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What makes you a true devotee of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is your commitment to him based on a prophetic experience of God. And a prophetic experience of God defies proofs, it defies intellectual argumentation. It just, you experience it, you feel it, you know that God exists based upon a face-to-face revelation. Right? So if that's really the basis of our faith, then all other types of argumentation and proof of God's existence and proof of all the things that Judaism professes really becomes unnecessary. But you do need at least the starting point. We who have not been privy to these face-to-face revelations do need some kind of foothold. We need some kind of basis to sort of hang our hat and say, why are we doing these things? You know, if there was no logic to the tradition process that we follow, then it would be difficult for, it's one thing to say, well, I've experienced God firsthand, so therefore I don't need anything else. But if I haven't experienced Hashem firsthand, but I've just heard a story about my ancestors who experienced Hashem firsthand, there needs to be some kind of logical connection to my ancestors and to me. Is it reasonable for me to believe that my ancestors really had that face-to-face revelation? And that's really what he's trying to set out to prove here. He's not trying to intellectually prove the truths of the Torah, but really he's trying to prove that it's logical to assume that the claims made in the Torah were actually happening. Okay? Yes?
In terms of saying, shouldn't he have come up with a better lie, aren't there other religions and other mythologies who have come up who also, like, these are things that other religions and other ancient artifacts, I think, have acknowledged, like a flood at some point.
Right.
Isn't that something that is not proven, but other religions sustain happen?
Yeah, the famous epic of Gilgamesh, right, is an example of how other ancient civilizations have made the same claim. But that actually...
Why is this necessarily the best story, I guess? Like, why...
Right, it's not. It's not so much that... If anything, the fact that other civilizations at the time had a similar account of a flood only helps to confirm what Rabbi Yehuda Levi is arguing, is that it couldn't have been made up, because if you wanted to make it up, you wouldn't have chosen such an outlandish lie. But it's not only that, but it's backed up by, there were other cultures at the time that had similar stories. So it was part of the history. A collective historical memory of the people of the ancient world that there was a flood. So it's not so much that we're saying that this proves that the biblical narrative is accurate, but really what he's trying to demonstrate is Moshe Rabbeinu is recording history for the Jewish people. He's telling them a story that they must have heard from other sources as well. Otherwise, someone would have gotten up in the crowd and said, what are you talking about? No one has ever heard this story before. How can you just be babbling on about something that is just so outlandish and no one's ever heard before? That's exactly the point. There must have been a Gilgamesh legacy in the ancient world of some. There must have been a story of a flood that was collectively circulating in the ancient world in order for Moshe's claim of this story to be credible. Now, of course, you'll note that the Gilgamesh story is very different in many of its details from the biblical account of the flood, but it's similar enough so that when the Jewish people heard this specific spin that Moshe was providing for them, they said, this is credible, right? That's really the point that he's making, yes?
What makes Judaism and Torah compared to Christianity is Islam just older, because the previous chapters, neither priest or imam refute the authenticity of Torah. They attach themselves to Torah. Maybe from their point of view, they're new and improved.
They are what?
They're newer and more improved theology, which is based on Torah, which
right.
The rabbi proves that it's authentic, but another one, they cling to the Torah.
Right. So he's not going to be dealing with the lack of authenticity of Islam and Christianity as much as he's going to be dealing in this section with the authenticity of the Torah as a historical document. But you can infer the opposite. If the basis of the truths of the Torah is the fact that it's a lie that is difficult to falsify, then look at the other religions and how they fabricated stories that are easy to falsify. And that's really what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had alluded to before in his discussion of Islam and Christianity. They are based upon personal revelations that are done in a cave or done within a very small group of people. Those are lies that are easy to pull off without people saying, hey, that's impossible because we were there and we never heard of such a thing. Yeah. Okay, so let's go into our text. So Moshe Rabbeinu chronicles for the Jewish people the years from Adam to the present and tells them the story of the flood, Noach's son Shem Ham and Yefet, the story of the Dor HaFlug of the Tower of Babel. So now we're on page 75, paragraph 44. We need a reader for today. Good, thank you.
The Kuzari said, if you truly have an exact reckoning of the years from the time of creation, this too is amazing. The rabbi said, we use this number in our calendars. No two Jews argue about this dating, no matter where they dwell. The Kuzari asked, and what year is it now according to you? The rabbi said, 4,500. Years are detailed in our Torah by chronicling the generations of man, starting from the time of Adam, his son Sheth, and his grandson Enosh, and down to Noah. Then to Noah's son Shem, and Shem's great-grandson Eber, and then down to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, then down to Moshe. These people were the heart and elite of mankind.
Hold on 1 second. So just take a look. He says that it's now the year 4,500. The year 4,000, we're now 5,772. So the book is representing that the year that this dialogue is taking place, if you do the math, it's the year 740 of the Common Era. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi did not live in the 8th century. He lived in the 12th century. But remember, what he's trying to do is trying to represent a dialogue that had happened, at least according to his legend, that happened 4 years previously. So am I making myself clear? Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is writing historical fiction. He is writing a biography of a dialogue that had taken place 400 years before he lived. The story of how the Khazar kingdom converted to Judaism. So he's recreating a dialogue that is occurring between the Khazar king and the rabbi, and he's saying that this took place, this whole dialogue is taking place sometime in the middle of the 8th century, really 400 years before he completes the Kuzari. Now, as far as the historical accuracy of that year, that's something that the historians debate, because there are some historians who say that the actual date of the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism may have been as recently as the 10th century and not as early as the 8th century. So there's a lot of there's some discrepancy here. But remember, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi was working with the folklore of his era. The story of the Khazars was a well-known fable, it was a well-known tale. that there was a whole nation of people who had converted to Judaism en masse. The folklore had been based upon the fact that there was a dream that the king had had, and all of this is recorded in thank you. The whole story was based upon the Chasdai letters that are published in the back of the book, which basically talk about this story. So we're not sure exactly when this conversion took place, but it took place, at least in Rebbe Yehuda Halevi's folklore, it took place sometime in the 8th century. So he continues by saying that the Torah chronicles the years from the time of creation, from the year zero, all the way to the present, and the way that it does that is by listing how long each person lived from Adam to the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. But if you note, he says, and this is a very important sentence, these people were the heart and elite of mankind. The people that are chronicled in the Torah, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, have a very special quality to them. They're different from every other person of their generation. And the Torah lists the people who, from Adam until Noah, from Noah until Avram Avinu, not just typical people that so-and-so begat so-and-so and so-and-so begat so-and-so. The names of the people that are mentioned in the Torah, in Parshas Bereishis and in Parshas Noah, are listed because each one of these people carried some kind of special genetics within their DNA that they passed on to the next generation. And that's a very bold claim indeed. Now, we're going to get back to this topic in a few weeks when we get to the end of the first essay, where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to say something even more dramatic, and he's going to say that the reason why the people that are listed in Tanakh lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, as you may note, you know, with the Metushelach was the longest living person. He lived 969 years. But that was the typical lifespan. People were living 700, 800, 900 years. The reason why these people lived such miraculously long lives was not because everyone was living such long lives back then, but rather because these people were the superhumans that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi had described in the previous section. If you're a superhuman, you can live for hundreds and hundreds of years and still retain your vigor and your strength. This was not the norm, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, and that was something we'll discuss later on. So these people were the heart and elite of mankind. Please continue.
Each had many children, but the Torah does not list all of them by name. Most of these children were like the peel of a fruit, not attaining their father's level since they did not possess the same divine qualities. The Torah therefore only chronicles those descendants who maintained this divine quality, who were the minority of the individual's progeny. This was true until Yaakov, the father of 12 tribes. Unlike the previous pattern, now each and every son was worthy of this divine quality. It was in this nation of 12 tribes that divinity settled, and this nation preserved the chronicling of mankind. In turn, we, their descendants, received this chronicling from Moshe, and we know the number of years from Moshe to the present.
So we have to basically look at the benefit of the chronicles that are contained in the Torah as providing us a dual benefit for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's perspective. Number one, it provides the history of the world from the time of creation to the present, so that we have an exact numbering of the years that are from the time of Adam HaRishon until Moshe Rabbeinu. And now that we know the numbers of years from Moshe Rabbeinu to the present based upon the continuing biblical record after Moshe Rabbeinu, going to the time of the Churban, the destruction of the first temple, then the 70-year period of exile in Babylon, and then the construction of the second temple and the subsequent destruction, and all of the chronicling of the period from the time of Churban by Yesheni until the present, we know exactly what the counting of years is. Okay? That's one purpose, to provide a historical record of the history of mankind. The second benefit is for us to know exactly who those unique individuals were from the time of Adam to the present, who passed this metagene, this sort of unique genetic, spiritual genetic quality from father to son, from generation to generation, until it passed down to Yaakov Avinu. And from Yaakov Avinu, even though normally and this is something that we're going to spend a little bit more time on next week. Normally, you were, if you possessed this unique gene, you only passed it on to one of your children. All of your other children were, what he says, what? Are the peel to the fruit. You had one child, you may have had a dozen children with many different wives, but you had one son, and apparently it went through the male gene, according to the way he's describing it. You had one son who possessed or carried on this metagene, this superhuman gene, and was able to carry it on to the next generation. All of your other children, like the Torah says in a number of different places, Vayoled banim uvanot. It says like so-and-so begat so-and-so at the age of such and such an age, and Vayoled banim uvanot, and he had many other children. So why is only this person's lineage mentioned? The answer is because he's carrying the superhuman gene. And all of the other children are like the fruit, are like the peel of the fruit. Now, we don't like to think of making favorites out of our kids, right? You don't want to think that one child of mine is the fruit, the other ones are the peel. But that's exactly the way Rabbi Yehuda Levi is describing it. And it's a very, very dramatic contrast between all of your other children. They're wonderful kids, they give you lots of nachas, but they're not carrying on this superhuman gene that is going on from one generation to the next. It changed. When did it change? It changed with Yaakov Avinu. Whereas Avraham only succeeded in passing on the gene to one of his children, because you know Avraham had lots of kids. We know that, right? Did you all know that Avraham Avinu had lots and lots of kids? He married Sarah. They had no children until after Yishmael was born. That was his second wife, Hagar. So then he has Yaakov. He's got Yaakov and Yishmael. But then in Parshas Chayei Sarah, it says that he married... He has Yitzchak and he has Yishmael. And then in the end of Parshas Chayisara, he marries Keturah. And it says, Vayoled banim uvanot, he had lots of children. So he might have had a dozen kids. Right? But only one of them is listed as carrying the special superhuman gene that goes through Avraham Avinu. Yitzchak has two sons. That we know, because he only had one wife, he had Rivka. We don't know of any other wives that he ever married. Torah doesn't give us any record that he ever married another wife, but he has two sons, and he only is able to successful in passing on the superhuman gene over to his son Yitzchak, and Esav doesn't carry it. And then something happens with Yaakov. Yaakov inherits the superhuman gene, and instead of just passing it along to one of his children, he succeeds in passing it along to all 12 of his sons. Sorry, Dina, she doesn't get it. It's only the 12 sons of Yaakov Avinu who are privy to this superhuman gene. And we have to examine and see what changed and how that changed. That's something we'll talk about next time, because we're going to have to sort of insert some of the blanks in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Doesn't really tell us about how this happened and how this affects how people's lifespans change. And the other thing that we have to examine, of course, is a very difficult subject, which is predestination versus free will. In other words, how much of our chosenness is based upon our own free will? And I think we talked about this last week. I think we touched upon this discussion last time as well. Yeah?
Yaakov is transferred to 11 of his sons, but only because two of the Shvatim are Yosef's sons.
Well, it was passed on to Yosef. And Yosef...
He
passed it on to all 12 sons, and all 12 sons permanently possessed that gene, okay. And they passed it on to all of their sons. There was no longer selection. Okay. From that point onwards, with the formation of the 12 tribes of Israel, every single descendant of the 12 tribes possessed that superhuman gene.
And the 12 tribes are Ephraim and Manasseh, which are Yosef's sons.
No. The 12 tribes, not counting Ephraim and Manasseh. We count Yosef as one, we count Levi as one. So there's a total of 12 sons. Okay? Got it? Okay, so I think this is a good place for us to sort of hold it over here for today. To understand that there's a lot of things that we still have to explain. Number one, how the change happens, that instead of passing from one father to one son out of many, it now branches off with Yaakov and it becomes all 12 sons. And we also have to explain what role free will choices of a righteous person contribute to our becoming the chosen people. That's something that we'll discuss in Yirtzeh Hashem next time.